Welcome to Back to the Sources, a podcast for those looking for a window into the life of Concordia Seminary and our library, whether you are a theologian, pastor, or prospective student. Each episode explores deep theological questions, profound insights, and topics of interest, brought to you by both professors and students alike. We hope that these conversations enrich your faith, academic, and professional development by connecting you to our rich resources. Back to the Sources is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.
Hello, and welcome to Back to the Sources. This is a podcast of Hasse Memorial Library. My name is Kendall Davis. I'm an STM student in exegetical theology. And today I have with me, as part of a series we're doing, interviewing all of the authors for Grapho. Grapho is the student journal of Concordia Seminary. I am the current chairman of the Student Publications Committee. And today I have with me Ben Vanderhyde, who is a student here at the seminary and one of our authors for today's Grapho. Ben, could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
So yeah, like you said, I'm a PhD student studying historical theology.
So Ben, you wrote on the fathers, patristics, as the kids say. Before we get into the details of your paper, could you tell us why does reading the fathers matter? Why should seminarians care?
Yeah, patristics is my interest, what I want to study and write on. I just think it's really important for us because, I mean, we're Lutherans, right? But it's really easy for us to kind of read on Luther what we want to make him. And so I think it's really important for the church, for the Lutheran church, to look at the people before Luther and the foundation that he built on, because he didn't just invent all this stuff. You know, he wasn't this amazing, this genius who just created a new church. He was standing on a tradition, on a foundation. And of course, he was calling the church back to its roots. And so what are those roots? And that, you know, and to understand that better, you know, not just the creeds, but, you know, what's behind the creeds. So Gregory of Nazianzus, for instance, is a really important figure surrounding the First Council of Constantinople and had influence in our confession of the deity of the Holy Spirit, you know. It's a big deal.
And so your essay, it's titled Impassioned Wonder, Theosis and the Place of Reason in Gregory Nazianzen's Theological Orations. So we'll start by unpacking
this. Nice long title.
No. So could you tell us just a little bit, you mentioned it before already, but who Gregory is, what theosis is, that seems to be a key term, and then just kind of lay out what you're doing in this essay in case somebody hasn't read what you've written yet.
There's a lot of big questions right there. So Gregory of Nazianzus, he's a 4th century father of the church. He's one of the Cappadocian fathers. So he's a friend of Basil the Great.
And in Asia Minor, right?
That's right. Asia Minor. Yeah. So Basil of Caesarea and his brother Gregory of Nyssa. And this is the other Gregory, Gregory of Nazianzus. And he kind of came onto the scene when he was the second presider over the Council of Constantinople. So there was a guy, Miletius, I think, and he died in the middle of the council. I don't think it was during the council.
Like while they're meeting.
Passed away as the council was going. So Gregory then becomes Bishop of Constantinople and presides over the council. But because of the politics and the like fierce debates in the in the council, he and people were attacking him and saying that he had been going against the canons of Nicaea and all this. So he kind of despaired of the politics and stepped down in the middle of the council. So he didn't even get to see it through.
Okay.
But he left his mark there, so that Nectarius then finishes out the council. And so anyway, so that's Gregory, but important Cappadocian father.
And he writes a lot on Christology, nature of God. You talk about the divinity of the Spirit as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep. So one of the opponents at this time are the Eunomians. These are the extreme Arians, because there are all kinds of different Arians at this time. And these are the guys who are saying the Son is actually unlike the Father.
Right.
In any way.
As opposed to saying of the same substance or similar, just completely unlike.
Right. So same substance. No, like of like substance, not even that. Like it's just
not unlike. Even like.
Unlike the Father. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's true. And so what is this term theosis? I think so some of our listeners might not be familiar.
So the paper's on the five theological orations mm-hmm. of Gregory of Nazianzus, and this is what like gets him his name in the history of the church. So future councils and people will refer to Gregory as the theologian because of these five orations. And as I was reading through them, I kept encountering this. One of the primary reasons Gregory says you can't say the Son isn't God, the Holy Spirit isn't God, is because the Son and the Spirit can't deify us if they're not God.
Mm-hmm.
If you take them down from that level, then they can't bring us up to that level. So right there in the orations, it's like, okay, what is this theosis thing? I got to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't really done a lot of work or thinking on theosis until this point, and it seemed like an important idea. So theosis is classically described by Athanasius,
mm-hmm.
and Irenaeus says it in similar language, but the words Athanasius uses are, God became man so that man might become God. And Irenaeus puts it this way. He says, he became what we are that he might make us what he is. And the Cappadocians and people of this time will say it quite boldly.
Yeah.
Saying like, becoming God is our goal and the object of our desires. So
we'll come back to that because I think that sort of language definitely makes Lutherans uncomfortable. That's a very strange way of talking about salvation. But we'll come to that. So that's what theosis is. So talk to us about what you're trying to do in this essay. What's your goal here?
Yeah. So I mean, the essay is a lot of just me trying to grapple with the theological orations as a whole and come to a better understanding of how this idea of theosis relates with the idea of reason, so, and the use of reason in theology. So one of the issues that's coming with the Eunomians, Gregory's opponents, is that they're using philosophy in a way to kind of constrict God and put him in a box.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying things like they've defined the essence of God as being unbegotten, for instance. So like, that's what it means to be God. And it's like, okay, it's true. I mean, that's what it means to be a father. Like, he's not begotten. He doesn't have a source behind him. He is the source,
you know, right,
from eternity. But then they take that statement and they say, so Jesus, or the Son, is begotten. And so they're completely different in that sense.
Therefore,
he's not God. Exactly. Yeah.
Good. So then, what are you trying to kind of get the reader to understand through this essay? Kind of about the orations and about what Gregory's doing with reason and
right.
theosis and against his opponents.
Right.
What do you want the reader to see?
So, really, the idea then is to show how Gregory's theology of theosis really heightens the mystery of the faith, whereas mm-hmm. the Eunomian theology and philosophy is really deadening the mystery, watering down the mystery, constricting the mystery into this box of this intelligible box.
Yeah, there's a way in which the Eunomian position is very, very clear logically, and I imagine that's what was attractive about it. But it seems to be that you're saying that Nazianzus is saying that attractiveness of that position, that it is logically clear, is actually its issue, its biggest issue.
Right.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Is that right? Okay.
Right.
So let's you talk about a lot in this essay about using reason in theology, and you examine how Gregory uses reason, you know, contrasting with, you know, Plato and Aristotle and all that. You know, I think a lot of Lutherans are used to talking about reason and theology in terms of a magisterial versus ministerial use of reason, you know? You know, and we accuse the Reformed of having a magisterial use of reason. You know, reason is kind of controlling the show. Whereas, you know, we good Lutherans, we let reason be a helper, even though sometimes we have less savory words to say about what reason is. And that's a conversation we've had on other episodes of this podcast before. But how does what you're talking about with Gregory kind of fit into that framework?
Yeah, this is one of those places where it's like, you know, I don't know if he even really fits. Like, so yeah. You could take this distinction between ministerial and magisterial and try and read it back on what was going on back then.
And that would be a mistake.
It, yeah. Well, It would work to an extent.
Yeah, yeah.
So essentially, the eunomian use of reason does not serve faith. In fact, it fights the faith. It diminishes the faith. You know,
yeah.
It turns it into just pure philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But Gregory's description of the relationship between faith and reason is not necessarily like this idea of ministerial. I would say it's not so much reason serving faith as it is faith serving reason, faith helping reason to be the best it can be, essentially. So there's this quotation, Gregory's way of putting it is faith gives fullness to reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to the Augustinian, the famous Augustinian phrase of faith seeking understanding. So faith is the foundation for a proper reason. And since God is the foundation of our faith, and Christ, as that what brings us into this participation in God, then to say that Jesus isn't God and to bring Jesus down to our level and to kill our chance of theosis, any possibility of our becoming, you know, in the mm-hmm. image of God like mm-hmm. that, then you've just killed our ability to reason. You know, you've killed the heart of our ability to reason and the foundation of our ability to be holy mm-hmm. as well, you know, in one fatal blow.
So it sounds like he would agree with, say, the assertion that, I don't know if you put it like this, but, you know, like because of the fall, our reason is limited or tarnished or whatever. But faith allows reason to do what it's supposed to do, right?
Absolutely.
Something
yep.
like that.
Yeah, but they do have a very strong view of the natural revelation and the in our image of God being our ability to think rationally and that being wrapped up into who we are as images of God.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah, no, I think that's helpful. So let's go back to that question about theosis. I find that Lutherans tend to be either kind of very interested in this concept or sometimes they're, you know, they get very like nervous about it because it can get into kind of weird stuff with like Monerma and the Finnish school or other issues, you know, we have in our own kind of theological tradition background. How would you explain kind of how this framing of this language of theosis can be helpful? And what are also some kind of guardrails that we might want to keep in mind? Of course, your paper isn't on like the Lutheran use of theosis,
right?
But just kind of like
right.
help people to yep. kind of understand.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll start with the guardrails. I mean, really, to talk about theosis for me is mainly a tool for helping me understand Gregory and for
right.
helping me understand like his orations and to appreciate his view of the faith. And so
this is just where he's coming.
Yeah, this is where he's coming from, and so it's not. You know, it's not about being like super thrilled about this cool new idea, this cool new way of seeing the Christian faith.
Right.
And you know, going east, but just understanding that tradition better. And then it helps you kind of see some things in Luther, because Luther isn't against the idea necessarily. And
right.
I think there's debate about how much his theology shows theosis. And I,
right.
but I do, so here's what my paper kind of laid out for why theosis is helpful.
Yeah.
So to me, it was helpful for understanding the relationship between the transcendent God and the revealed God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really easy, well, it's tempting and common to see this relationship played out in kind of a cosmic, like bipolar God, where the hidden God is law, essentially.
Yes.
It's like a law gospel cosmology. The hidden God is like law.
The revealed God is nice.
Gospel. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like you turn your back on the hidden God and you get the revealed God and it's all good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of theosis and Gregory's orations really helped me to see that there's also this, you can view these in a more linear way, where the revealed God, where there's a little more continuity between the hidden and the revealed. So the revealed God is the revealing of the hidden God. And it's not as if the revealed God is this like suddenly we understand everything there is to know about God and we can just
sure.
kind of take our little package of God and be like,
I got it now.
Yeah, you know, that's it. Now I've got the faith. Now I'm good. I don't have to think anymore or something. But the revealed God is that which pulls us into the mystery of God, into the transcendence of God, and brings us into that participation with what's higher than us.
So it sounds like you're saying that for Gregory, the revealed God is not an alternative to the transcendent God or the hidden God, to use Lutheran language, but it is kind of in almost like an appetizer, to use culinary metaphors. But it's to draw you in,
right,
to the contemplation, yeah, of the transcendent and the hidden God.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this more, about this concept of mystery. Gregory is a big fan of mystery, and you talk a lot about how he wants us to see God as mysterious. And that's something that he thinks his opponents fail to do. And Lutherans, of course, love to talk about mystery. We love it. It's so much fun, especially when, you know, you don't quite know how to explain a doctrine. You just, you know, tell people it's a mystery. And so, I mean, sometimes it can be an excuse for laziness.
Right.
And I of course, don't think that's what Gregory is doing. But how do you think, you know, what you've kind of seen in Gregory, how does this help us to see how mystery can be used helpfully, and how can we use this in our preaching and teaching, this category, yeah, of mystery, yeah, whether or not we use that term or,
right,
not, you know?
Right. Well, so I make this point towards the end of my paper, and it's like, if it's not a mystery, if the faith isn't a mystery, then it's like, if everything is already known, then why does it matter? You know, it's, right, kind of like Google has reduced the mysteries of life to just factoids. And you're like, you're curious about something that you see in life or in nature. You're, mm-hmm, like, oh, let me just go Google it, because I'm sure there's a fact and somebody's already figured it out. And the fact that it's all figured out and that there's nothing like mysterious about our world is really sad, and brings, like, it kind of deadens the joy of life, you know? And so I think life in the church can be kind of deadened if it's treated like we just know everything. And so we have all of these things partitioned in our theology, in our catechesis, and, like, mm-hmm, we have all of these terms for stuff like sin and forgiveness. Oh, and that over there, that's a mystery. And so we have that, you know, logged away, you know, it's like, okay, all right. Each thing is in its place. And then it's like, but then that's it. Like, we've done it. We've figured out the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it doesn't, like, nothing matters. And there's no joy. And there's, like, there's no straining forward to what's ahead.
Yeah.
And that's what Gregory shows and demonstrates in his,
yeah,
theology.
It sounds a lot like falling in love, in that there's something that is exciting about the mystery of learning the person you're falling in love with. And if you could somehow, like, download and straight into your brain, like, all the facts about that person, that wouldn't be the same. But there's something about the kind of the mysterious excitement of learning more and being surprised,
right,
well, by this person that you're falling in love with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that's kind of...
Absolutely.
That's a fitting, yeah, kind of way to think about it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, to love God, essentially. And so that gets back to the idea of the transcendent God. And if he's just this, like, mysterious, cruel figure that we run away from to the revealed God, then it seems like, just from that one perspective, it's hard to love him. But,
right,
the revealed God is pulling us into that transcendent God in a relationship of love and wonder. And that's the title of my paper, The Impassioned Wonder. That's from a quotation. It's the translation that I was using in the Popular Patristics series. But Gregory there, he's talking about Paul. He says, Paul tries to get there. I don't mean to God's nature, that he knew to be quite impossible, but only to God's judgments. Paul found no way through, no stopping place in his climb, since intellectual curiosity has no clear limit, and there is always some truth left to dawn on us. The marvel of it all, I share his feelings, as he closes his argument with impassioned wonder at the sort of things he calls the wealth and depth of God, in acknowledgement of the incomprehensibility of God's judgments.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's always pulling us in to keep trying to understand and to keep trying. And it's tied right, it's connected real close. It's entangled with our pursuit of righteousness in this life. So our striving for better understanding and our striving for living that is more in the shape and image of God.
One thought that's coming to my head is that there's a way in which the unknowability of God can either be, to use, you know, very Lutheran language, can be either law or gospel. In that the unknowability of God can be this thing that is terrifying. Or if you know the gospel, if you know who God is as he has revealed himself in Jesus, then that enables you to understand that even the unknowable God is a delight, is something that we should strive for.
Right.
Yeah, and that we can understand and relate to the unknowability of God in two very different ways, depending on where we're coming from.
Right.
Yeah. Would you have any suggestions for further resources for kind of folks if they're intrigued by kind of some of what you're talking about, like stuff they should consider checking out?
Yeah. Well, I'm always an advocate for Back to the Sources. So read Gregory of Nazianzus' Theological Orations. Mm-hmm. Those are great. But then for a Lutheran take, and I didn't get a chance to spend much time with this, but Schumacher's book, Who Do I Say That You Are, deals with theosis, Dr. Schumacher's book. And I need to go and look at that more closely.
Yeah.
But Jordan Cooper is also a guy in the Lutheran Church, confessional Lutheran guy, who's been thinking on theosis for a long time. And his first book, Christification, I was able to look through and peruse, and that's pretty good. But he's got another book, Union with Christ,
okay,
that I'd like to
worth checking out.
And read at some point.
So, that's really helpful. Well, Ben, thanks for your time, and thanks for talking to us about your essay and some of the ideas here. It's good.
Yeah, thank you, Kendall.
If you enjoyed Back to the Sources, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Facebook so that you don't miss a single episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.